It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at the future of federal marijuana policy after President Biden announced pardons for pot possession and directed his administration to look into reclassifying the drug. First, despite being seen as a vulnerable swing state incumbent, Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has embraced controversy in some cases in his bid for re-election this year. With the help of millions of dollars from Republican donors and groups, he's targeted Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes. As Rich Kramer reports, there are signs the approach may be working.
There are different ways to run campaigns in a 50-50 state like Wisconsin. There's the cautious approach, and then there's the one being taken by Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. During a recent gathering of a couple hundred Republicans at a Racine County Fairgrounds pavilion, Johnson delivers what sounds momentarily like a typical swing state speech. He calls for unity, and he says Republicans want to heal the nation.
Aren't you getting tired of the division and the anger?
But Johnson quickly pivots. He accuses Democrats of purposely driving up the cost of gas to force people into electric vehicles. He blames Democrats for inflation, saying it amounts to stealing people's savings. And he says progressives, like Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes, want to change the country because they don't like it.
This fundamental transformation of America is fundamentally destroying this country. We got to save it. These people have to be stopped.
The crowd at this rally feeds off of Johnson's remarks. Rich Strom, a Republican living near Burlington, says he likes that Johnson stands up for what he believes.
He's not your ordinary politician. He's a successful businessman, and he doesn't give the politically correct answers all the time. He does state things the way they are.
The list of Johnson's controversial statements is long. In just the past couple years, he has frustrated public health officials when he repeatedly questioned the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine. Republican Mary Lacomey of Union Grove says she agrees with Johnson.
He's been behind the COVID stuff. I think he's really gotten behind the people that have been, say, vaccine injured or worse.
Johnson has also downplayed the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And recently, text messages came to light showing Johnson's office tried to deliver slates of fake electors to former Vice President Mike Pence the day of January 6th. Former Democratic State Senate Majority Leader Chuck Koala says Johnson's involvement in the fake election scheme shows he's an enabler of Republicans pushing for autocracy.
He is not the one strategizing to make it happen, but he will help them make it happen, and that is a terrible danger for our democracy.
Johnson's controversial approach has worn thin with some Wisconsin voters based on years of polling by the Marquette University Law School. In recent years, a growing number of voters have held a negative view of Johnson. But Scott Jensen, a Republican lobbyist and former Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, says favorability ratings aren't the only thing that win elections.
Ron Johnson may not be able to improve his numbers, but he can dramatically reduce Mandela Barnes' numbers.
A Marquette poll in August showed Barnes leading Johnson by 7 percentage points among likely voters. But after Republicans spent tens of millions of dollars attacking Barnes for being soft on crime, that lead disappeared.
I think some of the early post-primary polling was too friendly to Barnes.
That's Jessica Taylor, the Senate and Governor's editor for the Cook Political Report.
Sources I talked to and my own analysis was that this was never going to be a 7-point race or something. Wisconsin is just too close for that, that this is going to be a 51-49, 52-48 race.
Several recent polls have showed Johnson leading Barnes, though the race remains tight. Taylor says the attacks on Barnes have been so successful that even if people dislike Johnson, there will be some who vote for him anyway. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR will have a story tomorrow about Senator Johnson's Democratic challenger, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Now, President Biden announced last week that he would issue pardons for all past federal convictions for simple marijuana possession. He's urging governors to do the same for possession convictions at the state level.
No one should be in jail just for using or possessing marijuana. It's already legal in many states. And criminal records for marijuana possession have led to needless barriers to employment, to housing, to educational opportunities. And that's before you address the racial disparities around who suffers the consequences.
The White House estimates the pardons would include around 6,500 people. Biden is also calling on the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Attorney General to review how marijuana is classified under federal law. It's still a long way from decriminalization or legalization, but policy experts say it's a significant shift. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support these pardons? Do you want to see similar things happen here in Wisconsin for marijuana possession? Do you want to see decriminalization, legalization at the federal level or here in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Hudak is Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the book Marijuana, A Short History. John, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back.
How big a shift do you see this announcement when it comes to how presidents of the United States are talking about marijuana policy?
Well, I think it's important to note who the president is who's doing this. Joe Biden spent a large part of his Senate career as a drug warrior, someone helping to harden the nation's drug laws, and that he is taking a step which is the most progressive step around cannabis policy that any president has taken in American history, is meaningful. It shows the amount of change that has happened in this country, particularly over the past 10 to 15 years. If you could get an individual like Joe Biden to be doing something like this as president, it shows that shift.
Looking at the specific policy items here, 6,500 people or so issued pardons under this announcement. This only people under a federal charge under federal law. I assume this will include people who aren't currently incarcerated. It will strike things from the record. How significant are those pardons themselves?
The pardons themselves are meaningful. For those 6,500 individuals, this essentially means that under the law, their conviction has gone away, and that's an important step. But more can be done. Pardons are not expungement. These crimes, these criminal convictions can still pop up on background checks, and this is just a first baby step in that direction. But it was also important for the president to do that second step that you mentioned, which was to encourage governors to follow suit. Most of the crimes for marijuana possession are charged at the state level. And we're talking about 500,000 arrests a year for cannabis-related crimes. More than 90% of them are for cannabis possession. And so the president can only do so much. His pardon power only reaches federal law. It does not extend to state law. And having governors follow his lead could have much more significant impact.
You've written about the impact of people being charged for marijuana possession having a very stark racial divide. What do you see?
Yeah, the data don't lie on this. We know that Black Americans are over three times more likely than white Americans to be arrested for cannabis charges. We know that those numbers still sustain at slightly lower disparity rates, but still sustain even in states that have legalized cannabis. The remaining crimes that are charged still have racial disparities. And we also know from research that at every step of the criminal justice system, Black and brown Americans are treated more harshly than are white Americans. So in the decision to arrest, the decision to prosecute, in terms of sentences when convictions happen, the rate at which convictions happen, this all disproportionately impacts people of color. And that is driven in large part because of the design of the drug war to be exactly that, to have racial disparities and to punish people of color at higher rates.
The other part of the president's announcement had to do with the classification, the schedule for marijuana as a drug. Where is it currently and what does that mean?
So the rescheduling process in federal drug laws is one that is clearly spelled out in the Controlled Substances Act, which is the main driving central law for drug policy in our country. And what it does is it spells out a process that the Attorney General and the Secretary of Health and Human Services will investigate and study this issue, and they will have researchers within both of those departments put together reports and make recommendations about whether cannabis is properly scheduled as a Schedule I substance, which it is now, which makes it illegal in all circumstances under federal law, with the exception of federally approved research. or whether it should move to another one of the schedules, 2 through 5, which are lower levels of control for cannabis, or they can make the determination that cannabis should be removed from the schedules altogether. And while I think that's very unlikely from this process, the discretion is there for quite a bit of a movement on or off the schedules.
We're talking about President Biden's federal marijuana policy, some announcements last week, pardons, and as we were just talking about, possible changing of the classification of marijuana. John Hudak stays with us from the Brookings Institution, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want the federal government to change the legal classification of marijuana to make it less illegal, to make it legal straight up? Would you support decriminalization or full legalization at the federal level? Here in Wisconsin, is this a voting issue for you? Stark differences between the candidates for governor, for example. Will you vote for someone based in part on their stance on marijuana? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with John Hudak, Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's written about marijuana policy, and he's with us today to talk about the impact of President Biden's federal pardons for marijuana possession, also encouraging governors to do the same, how the administration could shift policy on the drug, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Lee is with us in Madison. Lee, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I think Snoop Dogg summarized it up about the best. He said, put a bunch of brothers in a room with some weed in the air, and they're all gonna laugh and have a good time, or put four of them in a room with a bottle of alcohol, and somebody's probably gonna die. You know, I don't know how much more logic you could put it into.
Lee, I gotcha, John. The alcohol versus marijuana contrast. Why is alcohol legal and regulated as it is versus marijuana?
There's certainly historical traditions about why cannabis was put on the federal schedules and why alcohol was not. Alcohol was a pretty booming business in 1970, as it is today, and those business interests made sure that alcohol was protected from that type of scheduling in a way that cannabis was not. But for a lot of Americans, when they're thinking about the choice over whether to legalize cannabis or not at the ballot box, a lot of them make a pretty similar argument that Lee did, and that is that alcohol is much more dangerous in this country than cannabis is, or at least the perception is that. And if we can have one legal, we should be able to have both legal. And that's a process a lot of Americans think through when they consider these ballot initiatives in their states.
We'll go to Scott now in De Pere. Scott, hi.
Yeah, hi. Sorry, this is kind of related to the last caller. It is a comparison again to alcohol. As a father of teenagers, I would much rather my kids smoke marijuana and go driving than drink alcohol and go driving. You don't hear about fatalities from marijuana use and then going out and driving like you do about alcohol. The other thing is that you hear people say a lot that marijuana is a gateway drug. And I was just wondering if your expert on the panel has statistics that support or,
I gotcha. Don't. Scott, as a fellow parent, I would also discourage a smoking pot and driving. I want to have that out there. But John, to his second point, the gateway drug concept.
And I too will chip in there and say impaired driving is impaired driving and we should always avoid it at any cost. But in terms of the gateway effect, this is a notion that was conceived over the course of decades that has largely been disproven. The idea that there is something chemical in cannabis that will naturally push or graduate someone to a harder drug is really a myth. There are a lot of people in this country who have used cannabis during their lifetime. Tens of millions of people have. And very, very, very few of them end up graduating to harder substances. The reality of the gateway effect tends to come from the illicit market, from a dealer who earns a much better profit margin off of harder drugs And it is in the interest of that dealer to graduate someone from cannabis to harder drugs. It's not cannabis that's doing it as much as it is an illicit cannabis dealer.
Thanks for that call, Scott. Another Scott joins us calling from on the road. Scott, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Scott?
Well, I just want to say that it is long, long past due that we reform our marijuana laws. 30-plus years ago, I was convicted of intent to deliver marijuana. I'm a convicted felon 30 years on. Never had any other problems with the law. Never had any problems with the law except for this. My attorney told me, plead no contest. It's nobody cares about marijuana. It'll be legal any day. That was over 30 years ago.
Scott, thanks a lot for the call. John, a lot of people out there potentially like Scott carrying that felony conviction on the record from as long as 30 years ago.
Absolutely. Scott's story is not an original one, unfortunately. And those types of crimes were, you know, a lot of cannabis crimes, even simple possession in some states, were felonies up until very recently. And so the opportunities that are lost for individuals who have low-level cannabis offenses are significant. They're educational opportunities, housing opportunities, other economic opportunities like employment, much of what the president said the other day in his announcement. And states are recognizing that those are serious problems, and restorative justice programs are increasingly being attached to legalization efforts in the states, so that individuals like Scott and others who have been harmed by the war on drugs will see some of that go away. Now, granted, it doesn't change the history of lost opportunities, but if it can put people on the right path in the future to give them better opportunities, it's something that a lot of Americans want and a lot of states are starting to do.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. We're talking to John Hudak from the Brookings Institution about marijuana policy and politics. And John, we've seen some other states, we've talked about this in the past, where you've seen bipartisan efforts or sometimes a bipartisan support for referenda that legalize marijuana medically or recreationally. Then we have Wisconsin, a very strong contrast, a support in polls, a slight majority of Republicans support legalization when you survey them. But in our race for governor, for example, we've got Democratic Governor Evers, who had proposed legalization in his last budget, rejected in the legislature by Republicans there. His challenger, Republican Tim Michaels, joined all of his primary opponents saying, nope, no legalization here. What do you make of that divide here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that divide, particularly among elected officials, is real. When you look at votes in the United States Congress, for instance, on full-scale legalization, most every Democrat is supporting that legislation, and very few Republicans are. That contrasts, as you said, pretty dramatically with what we know about everyday partisans, everyday Republicans, everyday Democrats, not ones who are holding elected office, but just regular voters. Majorities of both parties support cannabis reform, but what we're seeing is that most voters don't hold elected officials accountable simply because they disagree with them on cannabis. Most voters care about a litany of other issues ahead of cannabis, and as a result of that, these elected officials can have those divergent views. But a day will come where voters will get fed up with that, and supporting continued prohibition will be a losing political play, and you'll start to see that shift even among elected Republicans.
And speaking of a shift, you mentioned President Biden as Senator Biden, very much looking for more punitive drug laws. Now he's changed. Talk about the shift you've seen over the last couple few decades on marijuana.
So a few things have happened in the electorate over the past few decades when it comes to cannabis. One is that there's a generational replacement effect going on. So typically the oldest Americans are the ones least supportive of legalization, and the youngest Americans in polling are the most supportive. And as older voters die off and as new voters turn 18 and are voting eligible, you're starting to see those kinds of shifts happening within the electorate in pretty rapid shifts as well. But it's not simply generational replacement, because as we follow cohorts of voters by age, the silent generation, the baby boomer generation, et cetera, we are seeing increases within those groups as well. So it's not just that new voters are changing the cannabis policy landscape, but people are changing their minds on cannabis policy.
Let's bring on one more caller. Chris is with us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Chris?
So I have a couple, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I just think that legalization federally just needs to happen, and states can, you know, choose how they want to do it, but they should not be able to block it. It's in this day and age, we have known medicinal and holistic uses for cannabis that, you know, from many, many, many years of its use in cancer patients and AIDS patients and et cetera. It's a plant. You can't tell me I can't have a plant. But you know, it's an entity of itself. It's not a medicinal, it's not a pharmaceutical. And so the ridiculousness of the scheduling, which is really kind of what drives a lot of the legalization, is, you know, very out of hand. And as they said before, a lot of it is just political and who lobbied best, you know, alcohol.
Chris, I gotcha. Just a minute or so left. John, your thoughts, Chris, talking about the medicinal uses there.
You know, Chris is, you know, verbalizing a worldview, a perspective on cannabis policy that I think has been a real driver in that public opinion change we were just discussing. A lot of people either use cannabis as medicine or know a friend or a family or a loved one who uses cannabis as medicine. And what they're seeing is that those individuals can have a normal life. They can get relief for their ailments. They are not out driving impaired, and that they are just the same person they were before they started using medical cannabis. And that, I think, is changing a lot of people's minds because they're seeing firsthand that A, cannabis has benefits, and B, that cannabis doesn't have the types of challenges or the types of fear that the government instilled in people for decades about this substance. And because people are seeing it with their own eyes, it is also changing people's minds on the topic and with their decision whether or not to legalize at the ballot box.
Chris, thanks for the call. And John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's John Hudak, Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the book, Marijuana, A Short History. He's with us today looking at a shift in federal marijuana policy from President Biden and where it could go from here at the national and state levels. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, what do you need to know to be financially literate? Get the basics and how to share them with a new generation. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. As some of you might know, I'm kind of interested in astronomy. Like, I'm not good at it. I don't know much about it. I don't have a telescope or anything. But it's pretty cool that we can see stuff that's floating in space from here on Earth. So we were driving home from a road trip on Saturday night, had a great view of the almost full moon and a bright dot nearby, turned out to be the planet Jupiter. I poked around online, found out that the full moon would be at its peak yesterday evening, and just coming up over the horizon after the sunset, so it was going to look super big and cool. I figured out the timing, more or less, went to a public park on a lake with a view in the right direction, and I got there in plenty of time to see clouds. Lots of clouds on the horizon. It was sort of dim view of a really big moon. Also, I learned that a lot of people do this, show up for a good view of a full moon. There were a handful of groups of people there looking in the same direction. Some of them brought food, but unfortunately I came and brought my bad sky luck and the clouds. The moon's going to still look pretty close to full tonight. Next full moon, November 8th, 6:02 a.m. according to NASA. Keep watching the skies. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we go inside Lambeau Field's Section Yellow, where Packers fans are creating a safe space for sober support on game day. Now, today is Indigenous Peoples Day. This year, the Oneida Nation is marking 200 years of living in Wisconsin. The tribe signed a treaty in 1822 that established the Oneida Reservation on land that would later be inside the boundaries of the state of Wisconsin. The bicentennial serves as a celebration of their adopted home and a stark reminder of their forced relocation from their original protected land in the state of New York. We're learning more about the history of the tribe and how they made Wisconsin their home. Brandon Yellowbird Stevens is vice chairman of the Oneida Nation. Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What does this 200-year mark mean to you and other members of the Oneida Nation?
What it means is just re-educating ourselves and reminding ourselves, you know, the long plight for the Oneidas coming from New York, upstate New York, and remembering that it wasn't always a nice, so bright history that we were removed from, usually around the Syracuse area, and having the Western encroachment, the New York's purchasing land from the Oneidas up in New York illegally, and having to sign the treaty, it wasn't necessarily a celebration. Mm-hmm. And so the 200-year commemoration really just highlights, you know, what our arrival to Wisconsin means, but also that brotherhood and sisterhood that we have with the Menominee Nation and the Ho-Chunk Nation here that were the first inhabitants of this area when we came.
I wanted to talk a little more about that earlier history. As I understand it, the Oneida Nation, their land was in theory protected under federal treaty in New York. New York State, as you mentioned, though, didn't honor that treaty. Can you talk a little more about that history?
So throughout the hundreds of years that we've been contesting that the illegal purchase of our land, we've actually won twice in the Supreme Court, saying that New York did in turn purchase the land without consent of the federal government, which is supposed to be kind of the mediator by constitution between states and tribes, and that didn't happen. And so in the Supreme Court cases, they did say that it was stolen, or not stolen, but purchased illegally. And so having that case won, we had to negotiate with the state of New York for remedy, because the Supreme Court basically said we cannot take the land back, but the state of New York had to provide some kind of remedy that would be an instance for the land, some kind of monetary settlement. Or in that period of time, in the late 1990s, we were in negotiations in early 2000s. We were negotiating with New York and other tribes a settlement, and their settlement clauses were basically trying to give us casinos, allowing casinos in the state of New York, and those fell through as a result of just New York politics is pretty convoluted over there. So those negotiations failed. But we still have an active settlement claim over in New York.
Now, here in 2022 in Wisconsin, what kind of things are you doing this year to commemorate this 200-year history?
Just as everything we're doing now, next year we're going to have a lot of festivities, just historical events that happened over the years. We're going to relive some of the battles. We're going to talk about some historical figures in Oneida history. We're going to talk about the treaties. We're basically trying to educate not only our community, but the broader community alike, that we have a long-standing relationship with the U.S. government that starts with the Revolutionary War. And having that conversation in education really invigorates why the Oneidas are here, but why the Oneida Nation fights so hard for jurisdiction and sovereignty of our areas, because when we were called to arms by the 13 colonies, the Oneida Nation answered.
You mentioned brotherhood and sisterhood with other tribes who were already here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the relationship between Oneida and Menominee and others?
We have a very strong relationship with the Menominee and the Ho-Chunk in the area, and as also Stockbridge Muncie came over with us from New York. And so there's a strong relationship between the tribes in this area. A lot of our families are interconnected, interwoven. Now we have a lot of Oneida Menominees, Oneida Ho-Chunks. And so our communities are pretty strong, and we do when we're speaking on the federal level, asking for more funding, adequate funding, community and trust responsibilities, we speak as one voice. And those are the things that we do as tribal leaders, is making sure that we are in constant communication on some of the struggles that we're having and how we share those with our congressional representation in Washington, D.C.
And as we wrap up, you mentioned part of the goal of the commemorations this year and next year are education. What would you hope people from outside the United community would know about the United Nation in Wisconsin in the modern day?
One of the things, we always talk about how the makeup of the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation was based on the Iroquois Confederacy. And that goes back into our great law of peace, which is basically our rules, our Constitution that we follow. And Benjamin Franklin and the founding fathers utilized that method of democracy that we use for our Six Nations, and how that relates into current day structure, the three branches of separation. And so the same as we did with the Iroquois Confederacy. And then furthermore, when the Revolutionary War started, we were able to verify and register in the Wisconsin Historical Society a letter from George Washington dated September 28th, 1775. And it says, Washington writes, "The Massachusetts General Court introducing Oneida Chief, who has arrived at the Continental Army encampment in Cambridge. Washington believes he has come in principally to satisfy his curiosity, but Washington hopes he will take a favorable report back to his people with important consequences to the American cause." And so that question that General Washington asked Oneida tribal leaders at that time was, will the Oneidas take up arms with the 13 colonies against the British? And so we did take that back, and we did join arms with the 13 colonies against the British. And we won a significant battle at Battle of Oriskany, and we helped Fort Stanwix, and also we helped George Washington cross the Delaware. And so when we say that, the Oneidas brought 600 bushels of corn to George Washington's starving army, and we fed them through the winter to make sure that they were strong enough to continue to fight. And so those are the things that we want to make sure that not the broader community, but all students and all community members, that Oneida had a significant impact on American history. And as long as we continue to have education and communication and conversations like this, we are able to find our commonalities and making sure that our communities and our municipalities and governments work together for all our communities.
Brandon, thanks for sharing this history with us.
Thank you.
Brandon Yellowbird Stevens is Vice Chairman of the United Nation with us today to share the 200-year anniversary of the United Nation in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran whose world opened up after joining the military.
Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha knew before she graduated high school that she wanted to see the world. She was ready for something different, for new experiences outside of her childhood home in Alabama. So she joined the Navy, traveled the globe, and made lifelong friends from many cultures along the way. Saylor's daughter, Erica Saylor, interviewed her about her experiences as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
My name is Lori McNeil Saylor. I am 59. I am also located in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I was originally born in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I moved to Mobile, Alabama after my mom passed. I was 4. And this wonderful woman named Alice adopted me. She already had 4 kids, my siblings. We grew up outside a lot, playing together, running around barefoot, just doing kid stuff. When did you enlist? I wanted to be somewhere other than Alabama. My thought process was, I didn't want to go into 13th grade, as I put it, because I didn't want to go to school with the same people that I went to high school with. I wasn't really comfortable with a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. I was a lot shyer then. So when they came to the school, it sounded interesting and I signed up.
What was basic training like?
You know, it was so different because now you're living with people from all over the country. I think that's where my interest in learning about other people came from, because there were, like I said, people from different cultures. And I remember this one young lady, she was just this tiny little curly haired blonde. And she asked me, can I touch your hair? And I looked at her and I was just like, sure. And afterwards she said, why is your hair different from mine? And I said, because that's the way God made it. And she was like, oh. It was so easy for her to understand that.
Is there someone that you served with you remember fondly?
My two most favorites are your Aunt Flo and your Aunt Trina, because I met one on the bus and the other one in boot camp. And we've been friends for over 30 years.
How do you think your time in the military affected you?
It opened my eyes a great deal as far as education, how to save money, just things that I hadn't really learned yet. You know, it gave me a lot of opportunities, you know, semi-free education, traveling. It definitely opened up my world and gave me the travel bug. That's the one thing I think is probably one of the most awesome things that the military did for me. I was there when they first put women on board ships. I was there when the Cold War ended, when Russia came to Norfolk, Virginia. I got to see that, you know, and I think I still have a Coke bottle with the Russian writing on it. So there are things that I got to see and experience that a lot of people don't get to do. So,
and you never would have.
Right. So I'm very grateful for the things that I was able to accomplish in the military.
Do you have any advice for someone who is interested in joining?
I believe traveling, learning about other cultures, it's probably the best thing that you can do for your own sense of being. It helps you open up your mind and your eyes, and you get to learn so much. So definitely education, travel. And I always tell them, find someone you want to emulate when you first join. Find someone that you would like to be like, and you follow them around, you ask them questions, you learn from them. You know, just absorb it all, make it worthwhile.
Right.
So I wish someone had told me that when I was joining, but I figured it out on my own.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
That was Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, we hear from two of the people who started the Sober Support Space for Packers fans, also known as Section Yellow, at Lambeau Field. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. At their best, sporting events can be a great way to bring people with different backgrounds and perspectives together. It could also bring them together to drink alcohol, and sometimes lots of it. For people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction or just trying to moderate their consumption, games at big venues like Green Bay's Lambeau Field can make things difficult. That's where Lambeau's Section Yellow comes in, a project that helps promote sobriety while cheering on the home team. Our next guests are part of the Section Yellow Project and members of the Brown County Alcohol and Drugs Coalition for Change. Tom Doofman is Assistant Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at St. Norbert College, president of the nonprofit Section Sober, which promotes sobriety in Brown County. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there, Rob.
And John Plageman is a social worker with the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Brown County. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
John, let's start with you. Section Yellow, I understand, was your idea. Where'd it come from?
So it came from the kind of the jam band scene, which is heavily into alcohol and drugs. And I follow the Grateful Dead and Phish. And when I got sober in 2009, one of my biggest fears was, how am I going to, you know, keep doing the fun things I want to do? And I remember there was a show, Phish was coming back from a hiatus in 2009. And I was really excited to go to that show, but I was only about 3 or 4 months sober at that time. and I found the fellowship. The fellowship with the PH word in front of it, because that's kind of their shtick. They are a sober fish fan group, and they actually have a table at every show. And I've been actually volunteering that since 2012. So come 2019, I'm getting ready to volunteer at the fish shows at Alpine Valley for a three-night run. And part of the coalition, we're leaving that after the meeting, and I just go up to Laura Hybe, who is kind of the chairperson of our coalition. I'm like, hey, can we get this at Lambeau? Can we get this sober table at Lambeau? It's such a simple idea, but it has such a strong impact and such big support. Because there are a ton of Packer fans that are sober that will not go to the games because of the drinking culture. So they're inspired the idea through the jam band world. And that sober table is exactly kind of how the idea started.
And Tom, how important is it for people seeking sobriety to have this alternative in a place where a lot of the pressure, a lot of the signs point toward drinking?
Well, we have over 1,200 members on our Facebook group, and so we have a strong contingent of folks that are either sober themselves or supporting somebody that is living a sober lifestyle. And it's good to have an oasis in a place where you are surrounded by folks that are having a good time and sometimes having way too much of a good time. Just to know that somebody else has your back and that they acknowledge you're doing something that may not be in the norm, but it is supported.
John, can you paint us a picture of if I walk up to Section Yellow at Lambeau, what happens?
Okay, so we're in the northwest end zone area. So we're by the Quick Trip gate by Section 110 and 112. We are by the designated driver booth, which is no longer there, but the kiosk is still there. So when you come up, you'll see a green tablecloth table with two volunteers who are in sobriety, and people come up and say, hey, I'm here, and you'll give them a sticker. And we have one game at a time sticker, because in recovery, it's one day at a time. So we give out one game at a time stickers, and we got Section Yellow stickers, and you know, they can come just to know that we're there. That's the main thing, just to check in. We take pictures, we post it on Facebook. We're just there for support. The interesting thing from the last game, we normally get about 20-ish people. And the Patriots game, which was a Milwaukee season ticket holder game, I don't think it had anything to do with Milwaukee season ticket holder, but we had over 60 people come up to the table that day. It was a very, very busy event, and we were really happy to see a lot of people. This is starting to be a rolling stone and gathering some moss.
Tom, Wisconsin has a reputation, unfortunately, I think an earned reputation, for being a place where drinking is very normalized in lots of social settings, expected in some ways. Can you talk about the importance of normalizing the option of not drinking in social settings?
Yeah, it's kind of a unique situation where you can be in the midst of this culture where it's really normalized to have one or five drinks in an evening, where other places that might not be the case. I have not used drugs or alcohol since September of 1982. So I spent my entire college career not drinking, and I went to the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point. So I've had a lot of practice at being around people that are consuming alcohol, but letting them know that it's not something I'm choosing to do, and they've been very supportive of it. So that's our main goal, is to let people know that you don't have to do this if you don't want to. And also, there are people that are choosing not to do this. And so when you think of Wisconsin and you think of the Packers, cheese, and beer, it's not always in that order. And some folks can appreciate all those things without using alcohol. So it's telling a story that's not often told.
John, in just our last minute or so, what is it like for you being at a fish show or being at Lambeau and having contact with people going through the same sorts of things in this setting?
It's the feeling of not being alone and being supported and not feeling that you're out on an island is a very strong connection. It's almost like a spiritual connection. We can still listen to the music. We can still go to the Packer games and cheer just as loud. And the emotional content that I feel at either, whether it's going to a Packer game or going to a concert, is just truly, truly amazing. So the one thing we just want to let people know is that if they're sober curious or they want to be a sober ally, to come to the Facebook group, join the Facebook group. All the information is there. And just know you're not alone.
Thanks to both of our guests for joining us today, John Plageman and Tom Doofman, both involved in the creation of Section Yellow, a sober, encouraging environment at Lambeau Field. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we continue our review of some big issues in the midterm elections with a focus on crime, public safety, and police funding, and how those topics have come up in the political debate. And can we feel better as we get older? We'll get lots of advice on healthier aging with the author of the new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.